Good morning, everyone. We're going to go ahead and call the Senate Committee on Judiciary to order. First piece of business, Mr. Campbell, would you be so kind to give us the chair that's next to Sheriff Myers and bring that up to the front? Thank you very much. I have four representatives or senators that are here that want to give testimony on the bills. So I'm going to go ahead and call Rep. Williamson, Senator Canope, Senator Shields, and Rep. McClain up, or those four can get their testimony and move forward. What we're going to do is, while they're coming up here, I'm opening up public hearings on virtually all of these bills. So I have to allow for opening, and let's see, I think all but 861, right?
That's correct.
A public hearing on Senate Bill 316. 639, 640, 641. Thank you all very much. And Rep. Huffman's here too.
Yeah.
John? Okay, who's going to start?
I can start. Is that okay?
Yep.
Ladies first.
Excellent. All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jennifer Williamson. I'm the state representative for House District 36, the west side of Portland. And we are here today to talk about our privacy and the fact that technology is moving so quickly that as policymakers, we have some real challenges ahead of us on how we balance our privacy with the safety of our communities. And what we know is that privacy issues are a growing concern for Americans, especially
Representative,
yes.
Before you go any further, it looks like I should open up a public hearing as well on Senate Bill 904.
Yes. It's on there. Yes. Thank you. So we know Americans are concerned about the increasing use of mass data collection and surveillance technology. And so this has prompted a lot of questions for policymakers around the country to deal with. And they're questions like, what are our oversight and sideboards that we need to enact in order to protect Oregonians and keep our communities safe when looking at the collection of data? In today's digital age, where so much is possible, what's the balance between the individual liberty and public safety? And most importantly, how do we protect our constituents' rights to privacy when our current policies lag far behind 21st century technology and data practices? We know that states across the country are dealing with this. At least 16 states have either passed or are currently considering legislation to address data collection. As you can see by this panel up here, this is a bipartisan, bicameral issue. And we know that, as I said, this is an issue for both Democrats and Republicans. In a recent Washington Post ABC News poll, they found that 70% of Democrats and 77% of Republicans, when asked about NSA surveillance, thought that the NSA surveillance practices were intrusive upon their privacy. So in front of you, you should have an article from the New York Times, actually on the 16th of this month, so just yesterday, about the very topic we're talking about. And the article has to do with the Santa Clara Police Department and the fact that they went in front of their city council to ask for $502,000 in order to purchase technology. But because of the non-disclosure agreement that they signed with the initial provider of the technology, they were unable to tell the city council what the money was for, what technology they were using, or what kind of data they were collecting. And so this is the kind of issue that we're hoping, as like I said, a bicameral bipartisan group, we're hoping to address in this package of bills. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Chip Shields, and I represent District 22, North and Northeast Portland in the Oregon State Senate. I'm here today to urge your support for Senate Bill 639, 640, 641, and Senate Bill 904. I'm here because my constituents, and I believe Oregonians, overwhelmingly see the need to make sure their privacy is protected. Updating Oregon's surveillance laws to reflect advances in modern surveillance technology is critical and timely today. The growing ability to collect and disseminate information electronically means we need to ensure the privacy of average Oregonians is protected, and this is not a partisan issue. All four of these bills take necessary steps to protect an individual's privacy and have broad bipartisan support and bicameral support. I would like to thank Senator Canope, Representative Williamson, and Rep. Huffman for working on these issues alongside the ACLU and in consultation with law enforcement. A particular thanks to my staff, Amanda, for attending the work group meetings, and for Stephen Elzinga in the Senate Republican office and Madeline Gardeau in Rep. Williamson's office for bird-dogging these amendment process. Lastly, I would like to thank the committee for taking up these four bills and safeguarding Oregon's right to privacy, and I urge your support. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
John.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members, John Huffman, State Rep for House District 59. I'll keep it brief because we've got great testimony here. I just wanted to let the committee know that these bills have been worked on, most of them, for probably 2+ years. And even though we don't have a formal caucus, maybe we should start the privacy caucus, because largely it's the same group of legislators and stakeholders in the room that we had on House Bill 2710, the drone bill, in 2013, and we've just kind of carried the privacy concepts into these bills. And so thank you for your time for hearing them, and look forward to some good testimony today. Thanks.
Thank you. Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. Tim Canope, State Senator from Senate District 27, which includes Bend, Redmond, Tumalo, and Sun River. I'm honored to be with this panel today. It's a bipartisan coalition, and I think because of technology advances, civil liberties is the issue of our time. And I want to make sure that we really balance the need of privacy with individuals with that of keeping the public safe. And I think that is the necessity that we have these bills with Senate Bill 640, 641, requiring law enforcement to obtain a warrant before accessing specific electronic information. And that relates to cell phones and cell phone locations as well. And then, of course, Senate Bill 639, creating new statewide guidelines for law enforcement using automatic license plate readers. And then the additional bills, I think, are of critical importance as well. And I think you can see from the bipartisan, bicameral nature of this that there is certainly a desire to make the necessary changes, and we want to work with law enforcement. I think all of us are law enforcement supporters. We want to make sure that we are taking care of public safety, but really, when you look at it, constitutional protections and our civil liberties are of the utmost importance, and I think need to be addressed in a more comprehensive way. And that is the reason for these bills, and I would encourage you to look at them, work with us, work with law enforcement. But we want to make progress on this issue this session, and we thank you for taking the time to hear these bills, and hopefully we'll get these through the process. Thank you.
All right. Questions for the reps or the senators? Thank you all very much. And I will tell you that we are planning on moving stuff forward. I will tell you that we have some work that's been ongoing as to compromises that have already been made on at least one of the bills. And so we'll be working together and keeping you all in the loop. Thank you. Let's go ahead and leave the four chairs there. This is going to work best since I just did my charts on this. First panel up is going to be Dave Fidanke, Kimberly McCollum, Gail Meyer, and Bronson James.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, David Fidanke, Executive Director of the ACLU of Oregon, testifying in support of Senate Bills 639, 640, 641, and 904. I beg the committee's forbearance as I go through what I hope will be a fairly quick PowerPoint. I have distributed to you all this morning a set of news clippings and other documents. Either I or Kimberly or Bronson will be addressing those as we go through. What we're talking about this morning, as the legislators, the co-sponsors of these bills said just a minute ago, is the intersection between rapidly evolving technology and privacy of Oregonians and Americans. In the last 15 years, our federal government and increasingly state and local governments have been utilizing technology not just to focus on individuals that may have done something wrong, but on all of us. And much of this information has been dribbling out over the past 3 years. What the federal government has been doing, we have been unable to get the courts to address. In the spring of 2013, a national ACLU case challenging the broad collection of telephone records and electronic communications records by the NSA, the National Security Agency, was dismissed by the U.S. Supreme Court on the basis that the plaintiffs in that lawsuit, which was included attorneys, human rights organizations, and journalists, could not prove, could not establish that they had been subjected to NSA surveillance of their telephone and electronic communications. What happened just a couple of months after that U.S. Supreme Court decision was that documents were passed from Edward Snowden on the right of your screen to journalist Glenn Greenwald on the left, standing next to me in that picture, when Greenwald was in Oregon in the spring of 2013. He had not yet made contact with Edward Snowden. That occurred in late May, early June of 2013. The first document that Greenwald published in the Guardian online edition was a Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court order issued against Verizon Business Networking Services to provide on a daily basis records of all communications. This is so-called metadata. But metadata, as I will show you in a minute, can disclose a lot of information about our private lives. Phone calls, to, from information, time of day, and in terms of electronic communication like emails, that same information, plus the subject line of an email. The National ACLU is a client of Verizon Business Networking Services in New York. And 10 days after the publication of this document, the ACLU filed a new lawsuit, which to date has not gotten to the U.S. Supreme Court. It's now in the Second Circuit Court of Appeals. There's a similar case moving up through the courts out of the D.C. Circuit. We don't know how the U.S. Supreme Court is going to rule on the constitutionality of this practice. What we do know is that the federal government has been doing everything it can to prevent a ruling on the merits about these kinds of practices. This is a recent story that's on the ACLU website about what the NSA is up to now. Going through the FISA court was not good enough for them. They have gone through the back door of internet communications overseas to get access to the content of communication without court authorization. And the way the internet works, they now have the capability of getting the content of everyone's emails that passes through those portals overseas. When you send an email to someone across town, it may go through one of those overseas portals, and often does, even though there are quicker routes to do so. Recently, this is another ACLU article on our website from late January. Under the Freedom of Information Act, we were able to get documents showing that the Drug Enforcement Administration is trying to amass all of the data on license plate readers that it can get, not only from its own cameras that it has set up around the country, but also from state and local jurisdictions who are being encouraged to pass on all of the license plate reader data that they are collecting to the DEA. Again, this includes location information about millions of innocent Americans. This is an infographic that is based on the Gmail account of Becky Strauss, former ACLU legislative director. There are a group of graduate students at MIT who, if you give them permission, will go into your Gmail account or your Yahoo account and analyze just the metadata, the to, from, date, time, and subject of your emails. What these blobs represent are the people that Becky had the most contact with over an eight-year period. And where those blobs overlap are intersections of groups that she has communicated with over that amount of time. This is the kind of analysis that federal agencies and possibly state and local agencies are able to do with just access to this metadata. What they want to be able to do, and make no mistake about it, is to be able to amass this data historically going forward without limitations so that they can go back at some later date when an individual comes under their suspicion for one reason or another to be able to analyze all of their communications and locations historically. This is the New York Times story that appeared just yesterday on the Stingray technology. Bronson will tell you more about this technology and how we believe it is being used in Oregon. But you have a copy of this in your packet, which discusses the Santa Clara County incident and the non-disclosure agreements that are being required by both the vendors and the Federal Department of Justice as a condition of receiving grants to purchase this equipment. The federal government is funding the purchase of this kind of equipment by state and local agencies. And they are not telling courts that they are using this technology when the information that they gather is then used to build probable cause to get a search warrant. And finally, we have information on two types of technology relating to portable devices that are able to break into anyone's cell phone and download all of the information on a cell phone. That is the topic of Senate Bill 641. And I will now turn things over to Kimberly to talk about the specific bills.
Good afternoon, Chairman Przanski and members of the committee. My name is Kimberly McCullough, and I'm here on behalf of the ACLU of Oregon. I'm going to talk a little bit about each bill, and then I want to just dive into a few specifics. and then I'm going to defer to my colleague Bronson James to explain some additional technology to you about that, which he's a bit more of an expert on. excuse me. First, I want to talk about just cell phones and, in particular, this technology and why Senate Bill 641 is so important. There are a number of different ways that law enforcement can, when they access a phone and they have a phone, they can actually, excuse me, they can get the data. Thank you.
Is it out?
I actually,
Don't leave us, Dave. Stay at the table.
Sorry about that, guys. I do have a water back there, too.
We'll bring it.
Thank you, Dave. And you're so nice. And you brought me some, too.
Dave would use it.
We'll share that.
There we go.
Sorry about that. Excuse me. So Senate Bill 641 requires a warrant and probable cause before a cell phone can be searched. That doesn't mean that that you need a warrant to seize it. You just can seize it, and then once you have the warrant, then you need probable cause to actually be able to search it. The reason this is very important is because our cell phones contain a huge amount of information about us. Our cell phones are essentially like accessing our own minds. We have everything in our phones these days. And as the technology develops and we get more applications and more ways to communicate with each other, our cell phones really contain everything. Who we're talking to, what our beliefs are, who our religious advisors are, who our friends are, who our political allies are, what sort of political activities we're involved in. There's just a huge amount of information. Also, our intimate relationships, just so many different things about a person. And so if you can just access all of that information, you really can paint a picture of really essentially what's inside a person's mind. And so that's particularly intrusive. This is fairly easy to do. Now, granted, easy. I should not say necessarily easy. It's complicated. But because we have people who are very, very good at technology, people who study this, then they've been able to come up with ways to essentially access the data on your phone and download it very, very easily. I want to highlight just two different types of technology. One is X-ray and the other is Cellbrite. We've given you some information from their websites. And I encourage you to look at their websites and see what they're advertising that they can do. They market these technologies to law enforcement and to military, essentially saying, look, you can use this to get people's information, to get these huge data dumps from people's cell phones fairly easily. one thing to point out is that they can get information from a phone that is locked. So this technology can be used to actually recover that security locked data. Now, granted, some phones have better security than others. So, for example, the brand new iPhone has encryption technology that it didn't have before. But there are a lot of cell phones that don't have that encryption ability. And so depending upon what you can afford, essentially, you can have more or less security in relation to these types of devices. And I'd like to suggest that a person's ability to afford fancier technology shouldn't be the basis for, you know, shouldn't be the thing that determines whether or not they have more privacy or less privacy. You know, if you can only afford the $10 cell phone at Fred Meyer that is also a smartphone, you can get a $10 cell phone at Fred Meyer that is a smartphone, that doesn't have the same kind of protections that the brand new iPhone has. So X-ray and Cellbrite can not only get into a locked phone, but they can also recover data that has been deleted from the phone. And there's a number of different ways to do that. But in particular, when you're using your cell phone, the information is not just on your phone, right? It's also going to all these applications that you're using. And so there's a lot of data mining that can be done by accessing that information through the phone that actually has been deleted and get that from all of those applications. And if you take a look at these websites, you'll see that they talk a lot about that. Mobile extractions can also be done fairly quickly. They can be done in the field. They're basically these like briefcases that they can get that have all of the stuff in them. They can do the data extraction fairly, fairly quickly. Granted, you know, what we're asking is for them to get a warrant in order to do that. That technology is available. So right now, without that requirement, they could essentially do this very, very, very quickly. I'd also just like to bring up something that I hear talked about a lot in this context, which is the idea that somebody can wipe a cell phone remotely, which is absolutely true. Someone can wipe a cell phone remotely. But I'd like to suggest that there's actually a fairly simple solution to this that I somehow don't ever hear anybody talk about, which is that a phone can't be wiped if it's in airplane mode, and you don't need a password to put a phone in airplane mode. So if there truly was some sort of emergency or some sort of real concern that a person was going to wipe their phone remotely once it had been seized, it would be fairly easy to actually resolve that without searching the phone. You just, if you have an iPhone, it's really simple. You just wipe up and press the airplane button, and that phone is now not accessible from the internet remotely. So that's just a little bit of detail about why Senate Bill 641 is so important. Senate Bill 640 deals with third parties that have our information. So that would be like your ISP or your phone provider. This bill would require, again, probable cause and a warrant in order to access that information from those third parties. Dave talked a little bit about metadata, and I think that it's extremely important that we really realize that in the aggregate, metadata, again, can tell a huge amount of information about a person. Who you're communicating is one part of it, how often you're communicating with them, when you're communicating. The subject lines are hugely important. Those can definitely communicate a lot about what's going on. Essentially, by aggregating that information, it really allows law enforcement to go on fishing expeditions. If we don't have some sort of controls here that are adequate, we essentially can step into a zone where we're in a dragnet, and that's not allowed under the Fourth Amendment. And we have very good standards under the Fourth Amendment for what you need to be able to get. There's mechanisms for what you need to get information, and we'd just like to suggest that probable cause is a very good standard, is tried and true, and because this information is, it really communicates so much that it should be subject to the same standard as the actual content of your email. I'd also just like to talk very quickly about our other bill, which is the ALPRs. As we know, the ALPR technology has been, it's been used for some time now, so we know that there's a lot of police departments that are actually already using this. It's unregulated, which means at this point, we don't actually know how it's being used. We don't know the specifics about how it's being used. And again, just like metadata, where you go can vary, it communicates a lot about who you are as a person. What church you go to, what doctor you go to, what sort of addiction treatment you're seeking, who your friends are, again, what political meetings you're going to. There's a huge amount of information that can be communicated regarding like where you're going. One thing that I just like to point out is how these ALPRs are used. I actually had initially had a little bit of a misconception about them myself, so I had to be educated. I thought that they were just going to generally be on the side of the road, but that's not actually how they work. They also can be mounted on the police cars themselves. So as they're driving around, they're picking up license plate after license plate after license plate, and that information is then sent back to their servers, and they essentially can then have, because of the GPS, they can say this car was at this place at this time. Now think about those on every police car driving around the city at all times, right? And you can create maps of where everybody has been. This, again, can be used for fishing expeditions, right? And so it's extremely important that we specify when these technologies are appropriately used. Certainly, they're very useful. And certainly, for example, in the case of a missing person, right, being able to identify that car and track it is extremely important. And so this bill carefully draws a line there of what are acceptable uses and what aren't acceptable uses. The fishing expedition is not acceptable. We really need to know what's going on with this. And if you talk to people in the public, and I have talked to people about this, people don't know this is happening. I mean, some people do, and they're extremely disturbed. A lot of other people don't, and that's part of why this bill is asking for some transparency, posting of the policies, explaining to people how this is being used so that people can actually know that, because this is something that really, it really bothers people. I think that that's, oh, I'd also like to just point out one additional thing about the ALPRs, is which I've heard is that it suggested that your license plate is not a personally identifying information. And I'd like to just respectfully disagree with that and explain that just like your social security number independently, if it's not, you know, attached to your name, may not be, you know, you may not know who that person is. The social security number is actually a doorway into who you are. It's fairly easy to find out, you know, like, okay, that's your social security number, and then find out all sorts of information about a person. Your driver or your license plate, although it may not have your name attached to it, it's fairly easy to figure out that that's who you are. There's all sorts of databases and information with our driver's license numbers, or you can just see that somebody got into their car. And so I'd like to suggest that your driver's license is, or excuse me, your license plate is actually a doorway into your identity, as opposed to something that's not personally identifying. So that's what I've got to say, and I'm going to turn it over to Bronson. Thank you for your time.
All right, let's just do a time check here. We have two more groups that I need to get in, and I know they're going to have a lot to say as well. So please limit your remarks as to what's new and different, so we can make sure we get everyone's opportunity to speak. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bronson James. I'm an attorney in Portland. I practice in state and federal court, both in Oregon and around the country. My practice involves a lot of digital data type issues. Prior to being an attorney, I worked in the information security and privacy industry for Fortune 500 companies and for the government, protecting and securing types of data. And now I work in the legal landscape of how the government accesses that data. I'm here today on behalf of the Electronic Frontier Foundation. We are a 25,000-member nationwide nonprofit organization who does work both in educational, litigation, and public policy statements about digital information, everything from the government's use of it to trademarks and copyrights. The Electronic Frontier Foundation is in support of these bills here today. I'm the first to acknowledge that as they stand now, I'm sure that the bills, any bill, can always be improved. And I'm happy to offer myself as a resource to this committee as those conversations continue throughout this session. I'll try to be brief and cover only the gaps that might exist at this point in the testimony. What the committee needs to understand is that data is now one of the most valuable commodities in our post-internet world. It's valuable from a private industrial standpoint, and it's incredibly valuable from a government standpoint, particularly in regards to law enforcement. Data has become priority number one for seizure by the government when they are investigating somebody. And they do that in a number of ways. You've heard about cell phone extractions. That certainly happens. It happens routinely. We know that these cell phone extraction devices exist and are employed in Oregon and are employed nationwide. These cell phone devices capture the entire contents of that phone. I have personally had cases in this state that we litigated where the government came in and tried to introduce a 6,200-page report of every piece of data extracted from a suspect's phone. Their letters to their wife, their finances, the pictures of their kids' birthdays were all sought to be admissible and part of the public court record. So this is happening in Oregon and it's happening nationwide. Another tool in this data collection arsenal is a device called a Stingray. Now, a Stingray was originally developed by the National Security Agency, and then was disseminated throughout all federal law enforcement. Virtually every federal law enforcement agency has them. And we know of at least 25 states that are employing Stingrays courtesy of their loan from the federal government. What a Stingray does is it masks itself as a cell tower. It's a suitcase-sized device. You sit it in a van, you park the van on the street, and all of the cell phones in that area believe that that is the legitimate cell tower that they should be communicating with, and all those cell phones then pass data. That data is collected by the Stingray, and it is filtered, and it is sifted, and it is read. In every instance that I'm aware of, and I caution to say I think probably every instance, where the government has been attempted to be forced to give up information about stingray use by the federal judiciary. They've instead opted to either dismiss the cases or to give people such incredible deals that the cases went away. So the stingray's operation, who has it, when it's being used, is a very closely held secret. But we do know that it is in use by at least 25 law enforcement agencies at the state level. And we know that because of leaked emails from the feds. Automatic license plate reader, another data collection. You've heard about that. In widespread use throughout the country, there is at least, in addition, four major metropolitan areas of the United States that have now begun to employ facial recognition cameras posted on poles throughout their major urban areas. These are very similar to the European facial recognition cameras. Those are collecting data as well. Then there is a program called Hemisphere. Hemisphere was developed by the Drug Enforcement Agency in partnership with cell phone providers. And what Hemisphere does is it pays for cell phone provider salaries to come and sit and partner with law enforcement agencies to do both real-time data intercept of phones as it's happening, coupled with historical data analysis. And what this does, for instance, is the historical data would say I could look at Mr. Dietrich's cell phone use 5 years ago, and given the pattern of who he called and when he called them, we can then extrapolate to a similar pattern now and discover what Mr. Dietrich's current phone number he's using is, and then intercept that in real time. We know that Hemisphere is being used with local law enforcement agencies, and we know that it has been in use in at least three counties in Oregon. What does all of this get you? What does all of this data get you? Well, of course, it gets you the odd, what we would say in the law is an inculpatory piece of information, so the smoking gun document. You occasionally get that in your broad trawl fishing net. But what you get that's far more valuable is disparate pieces of data that you can then amalgamate and draw inferences from. And there's a number of companies out there that are providing precisely this type of software that are marketing it to law enforcement agencies. One of those pieces of software is a piece of software called Beware. And what Beware does is it takes all of the data that's collected by law enforcement, as well as crawls the internet for all social history that a person may have created, every place that they've owned, every utility bill that they've had, everything they've posted on Facebook, Twitter, every user group they're a member of, et cetera, and creates a profile package for law enforcement. It then assigns a threat level to each citizen within that area for law enforcement to be able to prioritize where their attention should be in a given urban area. And there are multiple law enforcement agencies throughout the nation that are now employing Beware. So that's some of how this data is being utilized. Why is it important for this legislature to act? I was part of the legal team that recently litigated Riley versus California. That was the U.S. Supreme Court case that struck down the warrantless search under a very narrow exception to cell phones. What was interesting there is the court, in reaching its ruling in Riley, was relying on cases that predominantly came out of the 60s, and the most recent case that it relied on involved beepers. I don't know if you even remember beepers, but that was where the law was technologically advanced. The judiciary is not the appropriate part of government to litigate rapidly changing technology issues. It's not equipped to do it. It is too slow to act. That's why a number of state legislatures, as well as the federal government, are looking at legislative changes to prophylactically prescribe this type of governmental activity. That's why this legislature must act. The other reason I would give you, I'd like to read you a couple of quotes here. Preventing searches of cell phones has, quote, little chance of success under the rights-based Oregon constitutional analysis, end quote. And then another quote, simply because you have a vast quantity of items in your pocket does not mean you are entitled to an expectation of privacy in them, end quote. Those are both the official positions as published by the State Attorney General's office in cell phone cases that I have litigated against them personally in front of the Oregon Supreme Court. So I know you're going to hear from the Attorney General's office later. Any notion that this is not appropriate for a legislative fix is belied by the fact that that same agency has said it is not addressable under the Oregon Constitution. So with respect to...
Branson, I need you to wrap up,
sure.
Please.
With respect to the bills themselves, again, I'll offer my services to the committee in working through those, and we'll take that offline.
Thank you very much for your testimony and your offer to assist. Gail?
Thank you. Chair Przanski, members of the committee, Gail Meyer, on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, I'll keep my comments brief. What I'd like this committee to appreciate is how the acquisition and the use of these surveillance tools is evading oversight from all three branches of government. The police powers of government is evading the oversight of their own executive branch, meaning county councils, county commissions, because they acquire these surveillance tools through the back door. They don't go to their county council or their county commission and seek permission to acquire this stuff. It comes to them by and through grants through the Department of Justice, could be Homeland Security, but this is coming in through the back door. And this is being used and employed against civilians here in Oregon, and yet there has been no official executive branch governing body that has sanctioned their use. It evades the detection of the judiciary because there are non-disclosure agreements. The agencies, the law enforcement agencies, and make no mistake about it, Oregon law enforcement agencies are using the Stingray. There are non-disclosure agreements as a condition of acquiring the device. And it states right in there, let's see, I have a copy of a non-disclosure agreement when Tucson PD acquired the Stingray. The City of Tucson shall not discuss, publish, release, or disclose any information pertaining to the product covered under this non-disclosure agreement to any third party, individual, corporation, or other entity, including any affiliated or unaffiliated state, county, city, town, or village, or any other government entity without the written consent of the manufacturer. It's also not being disclosed in judicial applications for a search warrant. So in the instance when law enforcement is going to the courts in the context of a criminal investigation and they're applying for a search warrant affidavit, they will commence the search warrant from an objective facts X, and they'll move forward from there. But they don't ever disclose how it is that they learned somebody was in that house at that given date or time. And even when that is being opened up and disclosed in those very rare instances, in some cases across the United States, where defense counsel have been allowed to inquire into that objective fact and how they got that in the affidavit, even then law enforcement agencies and officers are saying, I'm sorry, I cannot discuss that. So ultimately, as Bronson James mentioned to you, in any case across the United States where this has actually come to rubber hitting the road in the courtroom, the government has either dismissed the case or they've given a sweetheart deal that the defense has accepted. And it's also evading detection by and through the legislature. And so I would encourage this committee to make inquiry of the people coming in behind us. Do you use a Stingray in the state? Are you employing that against the civilians of the people of Oregon? What about these other surveillance tools that have been discussed? We think it really is this body's job to act. The judiciary will always, always, always be years behind in adjudicating this. By the time Kylo versus United States, which was involved search with an infrared camera detection process. It was 10 years old. The technology was 10 years old when I got to the United States Supreme Court. In Riley, device at under issue there was 7 years old. So if there's going to be any real-time oversight, it needs to be by and through this branch of government, and we'd make a special plug for the Oversight Committee in Senate Bill 904. Thank you.
All right. Thank you all very much. Any questions that you need to have burning? Yes.
Just very burning. My whole life's in here. I know that. I don't know anybody's phone number anymore, for example. It's all in here. My schedule, everything. Do I have any reasonable expectation that somebody from the federal government wouldn't know I'm sitting here right now because I have this? Do I have that reasonable expectation? Dave, do I?
Senator Cruz. Calls for speculation or not?
Chair Pazansky. I think you should have a reasonable expectation of privacy.
Dave, it's not should I have, do I have?
No. I think we do.
Okay.
And I think that it should be irrelevant whether we have an expectation of privacy. The fundamental principle behind the Fourth Amendment and Article 1, Section 9 of the Oregon Bill of Rights is that unless we have done something wrong, the government shouldn't be searching through our papers and effects. And for the government to search through our electronic papers and effects, they should have a warrant and probable cause.
All right, thank you very much. The next panel is going to be Rob Bovet, Jeff Spalding, Jason Myers, and Ryan Lufkin. Gentlemen, who would like to start off?
I guess I can start. Chair Pazansky, Vice Chair Cruz, members of the committee, my name is Rob Bovet. I'm legal counsel for the Association of Oregon Counties. I'm not going to talk anything at all about law enforcement. I'm going to talk about other things and issues that I see with the bills. I'm going to speak specifically about Senate Bill 316, Senate Bill 640, and Senate Bill 641. The common thread among all three of these bills is that, as the previous panel described, it requires that government obtain a search warrant before accessing many of the modern technologies that have been described. And I understand the context in which those conversations have occurred is really in relation to law enforcement. But the way all three of these bills are drafted is incredibly broad and would impact government in ways that maybe folks haven't thought about. For example, if we were engaged in a personnel investigation involving, say, sexual harassment or some other personnel misconduct, we would have to get a search warrant to search even our own devices that the employees use. That's the way the bills read. I don't think that's the intent, so I think we need to recraft these things to essentially not tie our hands in conducting normal personnel investigations. Another example is defending ourselves in a tort claim action. A lot of tort claim actions these days are based on modern technology and things that people do tragically to each other through modern technology that are not crimes. We can't get a search warrant because you can only get a search warrant for probable cause that a crime has been committed to gather evidence related to a crime. Other examples may be nuisance enforcement, code enforcement, civil actions, again, defending ourselves in tort claims. So I have a number of concerns about how broadly these bills are drafted. I understand their intent, but these need a lot of work so they don't do a lot of unintended damage.
All right, Rob, thank you very much. And you, as everyone should expect, we're going to have ongoing work on this. And so I appreciate getting the highlights at 30,000-foot level. We are going to bring some different people in from all perspectives to kind of work through these issues. So, but thank you for the pointing out the your interest and your concerns. Who's next?
Thanks. Chair Pazansky, members of the Judiciary Committee, for the record, Jeff Spalding, police chief in the city of Beaverton. And I'm just going to kind of offer the brief introduction here, and then I'll turn over to Sheriff Myers. As it's no surprise that criminal enterprises are increasingly using technologies to facilitate crime. And as you might imagine, law enforcement leaders are under increased pressure to respond. these new technologies are developed and new tools are introduced to prevent crime, investigate crime, and keep our community safe. During the past several legislative sessions, the introduction of several measures that have been designed to address the deployment of these policing tools has prompted the law enforcement leaders to form the Law Enforcement Responsible Technology Group. The this group, we call the LERT, members are made up of public safety members from the Police Chiefs Association, the Sheriff's Association, the DA's Association, and experts in the area of law enforcement technologies, criminal investigations, agency accreditations, and best practices. The goals of the LERT are threefold. First off, to develop legislation to modernize our privacy statutes, ensure law enforcement implements new technology in a manner that carefully balances the privacy of our citizens and the safety of our community. We in law enforcement and prosecutors are sworn to uphold the state and federal constitution, and protecting the privacy of our citizens is an unwavering priority. We clearly get the concept that the balance between privacy protection and keeping our community safe is not an either-or proposition. It's a both-and. They do work harmoniously together. The second goal is to develop and align policies to ensure the utilization of new technologies is in keeping with the best practices and standards. We've used evidence-based research to create best practice framework to allow for flexible policies that can be tailored to meet the needs of all agencies throughout the state, that are can be tailored based on the agency's size, geographic region, et cetera. The third goal is to develop tools for law enforcement to assist in the areas of planning, implementation, training, deployment, and the proper management of new technologies. Our direction before deploying any new technology to agencies is that they shall adopt best practice policies and training to ensure that new technology is deployed responsibly. So with that, I will turn it over to Sheriff Jason Myers from Marion County.
Thank you.
Morning, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jason Myers. I'm a Marion County Sheriff and President of the Oregon State Sheriff's Association. And I think Chief Spaulding has said it well. We're willing to work in this area, and we certainly want to protect the all rights of citizens. And I think our demonstration of coming together prior to this session and putting together House Bill 2901 is a demonstration of that. Before Ryan Lufkin kind of goes into some details on 2901, I would like to call your attention to a chart that we included with your paperwork. And this really spells out the process by which we need to go through to get approval to access data and information. And so when you get a chance, if you can take a look at that, it's a good process and a thoughtful process and a process that protects the rights of everybody. With that, I will turn this over to Ryan.
Jason, regarding that memo or white paper you have for us, can you just show us what it looks like?
Yes, it's a blue in color. So it's attached to our
it's attached to mine as well in case
probably
you
want
to.
Okay.
Yeah, we don't have it at the dais. It may be in OLIS. If not, we're going to ask for y'all to submit it.
Okay. And good morning, Chair Przanski, members of the District Committee. My name is Ryan Lufkin. I'm a Deputy District Attorney with Multnomah County, a member of the LERT Group, and I worked extensively on crafting House Bill 2901. The chart that the Sheriff was referring to, I was going to cover anyways. It's just a summary of how law enforcement has to engage in certain particular elements of process to get access to information already. I think that this is a piece of information that's critical for you to understand if you're going to legislate on this subject, and I don't think it's been covered very extensively. So in summary form, right now today, Oregon law enforcement, in order to get information, has to go through various levels of process based on the type of privacy interest that is being intruded upon. Starting at the far end of the spectrum is information that is publicly accessible to anyone. That information, law enforcement doesn't have any additional burden than you or I or any member of the public would have in order to get access to that type of information. As you step up from that to items of information that are held by businesses as part of their duties as a business, Oregon law enforcement has to obtain a subpoena. And in Oregon, law enforcement presents that subpoena to a grand jury before accessing any of that information. What that means is that seven members of the community hear about the investigation, the purpose behind the subpoena, and why those records would be relevant and material to investigate a current crime that Oregon law enforcement is investigating. Those members of the grand jury then approve or deny of law enforcement's request to use a subpoena power. Up from that level of scrutiny are certain types of records that have been designated by usually the legislature as particularly private, like medical records. When you're dealing with those kinds of records, there's usually a fairly routine statutory scheme that Oregon law enforcement goes through in order to access and preserve those records. They do not involve search warrants. They involve applying for a court order based on some lower standard, usually reasonable suspicion, or simply a subpoena with a protective order that guides law enforcement through a judicial scrutiny level process on how to apply, obtain, and use those types of records. That's what's in place for your private medical records right now. Above that are certain elements of additional scrutiny that come into play by statute or by constitutional process to obtain certain other types of information, leading ultimately to a search warrant for lots of different items of information that are constitutionally protected, like the content of your speech, emails that you send, text messages that you have on your phone, and frankly, at this point, basically all of the contents of your phone pursuant to a most recent U.S. Supreme Court case that we've already heard about. That's the spectrum that's involved. And so when the LIRT group took a look at this issue, there's a couple of fundamental things that we want to make clear. One, we absolutely believe that this is a topic that the legislature should legislate on. There are things that need to be modernized in Oregon statute, brought into concurrence with what technology currently exists. And two, that process of modernization and additional privacy protections can be put in place without diminishing law enforcement's ability to do its job in the way that we've become accustomed over the last 20 years of decreasing crime rates over and over and over, so that we don't have to sacrifice safety to get the type of protection that Oregonians deserve for modern technology. That's what's in House Bill 2901, and I want to walk you through just kind of an overview of what that bill does, and then what it doesn't do as compared to what is presented in the Senate bill. The tools that Oregon law enforcement need that are in House Bill 2901 include the preservation of those three levels of process: subpoenas for business records, court orders based on certain specific criteria for location information that's historical, and search warrants for ongoing monitoring or surveillance of a person's current and future location, and certainly search warrants for any content of any communication that's been sent or received. That's the fundamental basis that Oregon law enforcement needs in order to be able to do the job that it's been tasked to do. As you move those things all up and conflate them into warrant process, which is essentially what the Senate bill is intending to do, you are taking literally hundreds of applications out of these other lower forms of scrutiny and per month and placing them into court supervision. It's simply not feasible for Oregon law enforcement to write all these applications, the judiciary to review them. It's going to be an absolute mess to have to deal with. So what we need from Oregon law enforcement's perspective is that three-tiered approach in order to be able to accomplish the job that we've been set out to do. That's what House Bill 2901 does. What it also does is preserve the ability to get historical location information through the court order process. And that's probably one of the more fundamental points of disagreement between the Senate bill and the House bill. That process, to be clear, involves going to a judge and writing out an affidavit supported to a reasonable suspicion standard with a court order that spells out what records are going to be obtained and for how long. What House Bill 2901 does is build on top of that practice and include additional protections for Oregonians, which include that law enforcement shall have a retention schedule for records that are not used in a criminal investigation, so that there is a destruction of this of these records that occurs after the statute of limitations is passed for the crimes that the that were originally sought to be investigated. This is intended to address some of the concerns from the previous panel about the aggregation of huge amounts of data by Oregon law enforcement. As an aside, to bring that into a more reality-based perspective, your largest metropolitan police force, the Portland Police Bureau, has exactly one officer, his name is Fred, who does all of the review for search warrants and cell phones. And the idea that Fred has the time to go around creating the kinds of charts that I've seen today, it's just we're not anywhere close to that. So I don't know what the federal government is up to, but Oregon law enforcement does not have the capacity to go through and create huge databases of information and generate out all the type of interesting charts that I saw earlier. House Bill 2901 also updates the pen register statute. This was a statute that the legislature crafted to address a technology concern where law enforcement wanted to get the signaling information to determine only what phone number was dialed by a particular person. That statute is still good, but it doesn't address the more modern practice of not using physical devices to accomplish that task, but rather software and processes through the cell phone company to address that task. So House Bill 2901 identified that as a concern, wanted to address it, and had it modernized to make sure that it's consistent with current practice. It also provides for a consistent list of exceptions to the warrant requirement that are all based in constitutionally firm principles, including exigency, consent, stolen devices, emergency service requests, missing and endangered persons, all things that have been constitutionally challenged and found to be correct exceptions to the warrant requirement are relayed into the multiple different privacy elements of House Bill 2901. It also provides for a specific criteria that Oregon law enforcement needs to place into their applications for court orders, including the identity of the subscriber if it is known, facts supporting reasonable suspicion, and how records will assist in the investigation, and a judge would need to approve that. It also includes an expansion to the mobile tracking section of the statutes. That was originally designed for technology that assisted law enforcement in placing devices onto cars to track people around. That is what we believe the appropriate vehicle should be to address ongoing monitoring of people through any electronic means. That is a search warrant process. It is already a search warrant process in the statute, and through a simple definitional change with a little broadening of the language, we would cover all forms of electronic processes, devices, what have you, that track a person's ongoing movements. Finally, a few critiques on the Senate bill side on what's going on through 640. Some of the things that are in here that need to be looked at are the notice to the provider. There's a provision in here that would require Oregon law enforcement to provide notice to the suspect of their investigation about what their investigation is, what records they obtained, the date range for the records that are being obtained, and if they ever sought to delay notice. In order to not do that, which would, of course, blow up any investigation of any criminal offense if you actually did provide notice to someone, you have to apply to a court every 90 days to waive that notice for another 90 days. That requirement is completely impractical. You have murder investigations that go on for years. You'd be going every 90 days to a judge to continue to do something which is so obviously not appropriate, which is to inform the suspect of your murder investigation of all of the evidence and what you're trying to get from his records. So that's a big flag I wanted to raise there. There are also things in this bill that are impractical and don't seem to have the intended effect that they were written to do, one which being the bill requires Oregon law enforcement to file a report to the court whenever it has relied on exigency to obtain records. There's absolutely nothing the court could do with such a report. It would be just filed, and the court would have no ability to do anything with it. So it's unclear to me, other than creating more work, what that provision is intended to accomplish. And then finally, it requests a report back to the legislature with pieces of information that can't be obtained in any reasonable way by Oregon law enforcement every year, and would include in a publicly available document current and ongoing criminal investigations so that your suspects could again find out exactly what they're being investigated for before you've even had a chance to complete your investigation. There are also some jurisdictional limits that I don't understand and probably need to be looked at. These include limits that try to ensure that this type of process can only be affected on Oregon residents or on a business doing or in a business that's in Oregon, which in my reading of the language that they've used means that a criminal who lives in Vancouver and commits a crime in Portland, we would be unable to obtain their records even through this process that they've placed in the statute. So I'm not sure that that's what was intended, and I think it needs to be looked at. Finally, on Senate Bill 316, I just want to raise a comment. This is essentially the same bill, but trying to prohibit cell phone companies from doing the types of things that federal law requires them to do. I think that would be preempted fairly clearly. I think you can structure what you need for Oregon law enforcement, but I don't think that you'd be successful in preventing foreign phone companies from complying with federal law. I have additional comments on ALPR, but...
But you already said finally twice.
Yes, and I will conclude. Thank you.
And guess what? Okay, any burning questions? Thank you very much, gentlemen. The next panel is going to be Leonard Williamson, Michael Slauson, Aaron Knott, and who am I missing? Kevin Campbell. And gentlemen, we're about 15 minutes out from me losing members.
Got it. Chair Przanski and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kevin Campbell. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police. You've already heard from a number of our folks on a number of these bills, so I'm only speaking to Senate Bill 639, which is the ALPR bill. And my purpose for doing so is just to acknowledge the work that we've done with the chair and members of the committee and in conversations with representatives of ACLU regarding one portion of that measure, and that is the retention period. As you know, that's been an issue of debate and contention. We obviously would like a longer period of retention. ACLU and others would like shorter. And in conversations, I just want to acknowledge that we've talked about with proponents a year period of time, which we can live with. And I just wanted to put that on the record. There are some other technical issues in the bill, and I'd like to ask for permission to work with proponents and maybe with this committee in order to work through technical details that are also problematic in the bill. And we can go into additional detail later. But I did want to put that on the record.
That's great. Thank you very much.
Chair.
Go ahead.
Okay. Chair Przanski, members of the committee, my name is Aaron Knott. I'm the legislative director for the Attorney General in the Oregon Department of Justice. I'm here solely on 641, which is the bill which pertains to electronic devices, cell phones, and we are here in opposition to 641. I just want to put the reasons down briefly. The genesis of this concept, as I think Mr. James established, was a Supreme Court case called Riley v. California, which basically said when you're arrested, police officers can't use the fact of your arrest as a justification to get in your phone. Prior to that decision, they're thinking of phones the same way they thought of wallets. It was a good way to get good basic information about you. But the Supreme Court recognized that that's different than getting into, as Senator Cruz put it, your entire life. SB 641 differs from that decision in three very important ways. Number one, it expands from cell phones or smartphones only to all portable electronic devices. The last two are probably more important. Second, it applies this requirement that you can't get into a cell phone without a warrant to all public bodies. Now, we've been hearing about law enforcement, but the definition of public bodies includes agencies, cities, counties, commissions. And then finally, it eliminates all exceptions to the warrant requirement except for an immediate threat to public safety. Now, very briefly on the latter two. Public bodies cannot generally obtain search warrants. The statute makes it clear. You have to be a DA or you have to be what we would think of as law enforcement. But SB 641 imposes that requirement on public bodies. As a practical matter, this means that any time that a public body wanted to get into a phone for any reason, they would have to find somebody in law enforcement or a prosecution's office to file it for them. And they'd have to be able to articulate facts sufficient to establish the existence of a crime. Two very quick examples why you might want to get into a phone and wouldn't be able to. Somebody in your office is sending out inappropriate materials, harassing materials, not to the level of a crime, but it creates a hostile work environment. That happens at counties and cities. You'd need a search warrant to verify whether they are, in fact, using their phone in that way. You get a public records request. It impacts the contents of your phone. Again, you would need a search warrant. Point is, it's impossible for public bodies to comply with this. And then finally, the elimination of all other exceptions to the warrant requirement. So the way 641 is written right now, you can only get into a phone upon a showing of an imminent threat to public safety. There are at least 14 other exceptions to the warrant requirement, and I will not list them all, but some of them are very important. One of the big ones, consent. Even if somebody says to a law enforcement person, please look into my phone, under 641 they can't. And that happens without standing for who that person is. So if a crime victim says, hey, he's texting me saying that he's coming to my house right now, the defendant would potentially have the standing to object to the search of the victim's phone. Plain view. If you pull somebody over, well, no, say you find somebody standing outside of their car and they reek of alcohol and you are 99% sure that they're DUII, but sitting on the dashboard, you can see somebody texting that person saying, please, please don't tell them I was driving. That's exculpatory evidence. I mean, that's actually probably good for the person that you've stopped it. It casts doubt on the fact that they were driving at all. Under 641, plain view is also excluded. And there are a lot more like this. Lost and abandoned property, an officer finds a phone and wants to look into it to find the owner. Community caretaking, they're looking for a person known to be suicidal, but they don't find the person, they just find their phone. The point is, 641, in the name of addressing a very real harm, throws out decades, if not centuries, of case law on recognized exceptions to the warrant requirement. The change can fairly be described as drastic. It's for that reason that I am opposed to Senate Bill 641, but we are happy to work on cutting that back a little.
Thank you. Michael, you're next.
Thank you. Chair Przanski, members of the committee, my name is Michael Slosson. I'm an Assistant Attorney General of the Department of Justice. My current assignment is a Special Counsel on Public Safety. I'm here to testify in opposition to Senate Bill 316 and 640. My plan was to talk a little bit about federal law and the framework that applies to government access to this type of information. That's already been done. The one point I would like to make, though, is that we're talking about process that's required to obtain information. Even on the most basic level, so basic information about a person, their name, their address, billing information that we want from a service provider requires a subpoena. And we've heard a lot about aggregating data and looking at metadata, but I just want to point out to the committee that even a subpoena is a meaningful process. From the Attorney General's perspective, if we want to issue a subpoena in a criminal case, we can only subpoena records that are relevant to that criminal case. We can't, if we have somebody under investigation, we can't just generally issue subpoenas about their daily lives to learn information about that person. It's got to be relevant to the criminal investigation. It's even more burdensome for the local district attorney. The district attorney has to go before the grand jury, which involves seven members of that community, and get their permission to issue a subpoena. So I just want to point out that when we're talking about this, even the most basic process prescribed by federal law is meaningful. And I point out also with Senate Bill 316 and 640, it suffers from the same issues that Mr. Knott already described with Senate Bill 641, which is it applies equally to all public bodies. They don't have the ability to get search warrants. And that can be really important in some cases when you think about fraud-related cases. If our civil enforcement section is going after potentially a fraudulent business, somebody's cheating customers, in any kind of online type investigation, the first thing you need to know is who is the person? Who's the target of this investigation? Where's that person located? That requires basic information from a service provider. And it's not just a problem for civil cases. It's also a really big problem for criminal cases. And it's particularly problematic for an issue of great import to the AG, which involves the sexual exploitation of children. That happens a lot online. And in particular, at the Department of Justice, we house Internet Crimes Against Children Task Force. That task force is tasked with interdiction on child exploitation crimes, and they're tasked with processing what are called cyber tips. Cyber tips initially come from service providers, and so it's required under federal law. So I'll give you an example. Somebody sends an email that contains child pornography across Google servers. Google has an obligation to report that to the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. The National Center for Missing and Exploited Children then in turn finds out, where did that happen? Oh, that looks like that came out of Oregon. They report that, that's called a cyber tip, to us at the Department of Justice. We process that cyber tip. What we get with that cyber tip might be John Smith at Yahoo.com using this particular IP address on this date and time sent the email. The first step the ICAC task force has to take is identifying who that person is. Which county are they in? Is it really in Oregon? What's the name of that person? That requires us to go to a service provider. We have to find out, okay, who owns that IP address? It's Verizon or it's Comcast, whomever. We send a subpoena under current law to Comcast to say, who owns that? And then we find out, or who's the subscriber that's assigned to that IP address? That's how we find out who our targets are. This would require a warrant. Now, there may be circumstances in which we could meet that burden, but think about it. Right now, there's so much of this going on. Resources are the main issue. Having these types of burdens on law enforcement, especially in this type of context, would cut their ability to process cases in half. That's just more people out on the street offending children that we can't stop. That's the same true when you think about these notice requirements and the reporting requirements. You're imposing a lot of burdens on law enforcement, and that just distracts them from doing the good work that they need to do to protect kids. I'd point out, too, just how unworkable some of these provisions of the bill are in real-life context. And so this prohibits, absent a warrant in both of these bills, really any information, right, from a service provider, especially when you're talking about Senate Bill 640, prohibits access to location information. Think about that. Location information. Any information from the use of a device could be used to discern a person's location. That's an area code. That's a zip code. That's an IP address. And it applies to all public bodies. So in a criminal context, you know, you've heard a lot about this in recent news stories about people who their deaths initially to law enforcement, any death investigation appears initially accidental. There's a story not that long ago about a man in Portland who the police initially thought had fallen and hit his head. It turns out later on they learned it's a homicide. There's another story about a woman who was in a pool. That's a real-life situation that law enforcement encounters. Don't know if it's a crime initially. Don't know what happened. And one of the tools available to law enforcement would be to find out, like, well, did they use their cell phones? Did they make calls anywhere? Can we tell where the person last was? Maybe they were last with a boyfriend. Maybe they were a girlfriend. That's the person you want to talk to. 640 and 316 make that impossible to do absent getting a warrant, but the police won't have probable cause. They won't have access to that information, and they don't know. And so, and even if they do, even if they say, you know, let's push it. I think we're there. I think we can get probable cause. Let's get those records. This imposes other additional requirements on it that make it also impossible. So if I'm getting the records of the person who's deceased from a law enforcement perspective, who do I send notice to? And if I screw that up, if I do something wrong, even a technical violation, I'm going to lose that evidence. That's a great cost to the citizens. And it doesn't even require that the person whose rights, who's had a privacy interest in the information, actually be violated. It could be anybody. So in that case, when you have a death you think is maybe accidental or homicidal, you don't know. At the end of the day, when you find out who the murderer actually is, that murderer can challenge the admission of evidence that belonged to the victim. If there's anything further from the committee, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Michael, thank you very much. Leonard, you're up, and you got about 3 minutes.
Okay. My name is Leonard Williamson. I'm the Inspector General for the Oregon Department of Corrections. Chair, Vice Chair, committee members, I'm here not in a capacity to talk about Fourth Amendment protections for our citizens. I'm here to talk about inmates who are in custody under the Eighth Amendment and whether or not these statutory provisions under 613, 639, 640, or 641 should apply to those inmates. Technology is here. It's now in our prison system. We have a fairly modern, robust telephone prison infrastructure. It's been in place for 2 years. I can monitor phone calls remotely from my iPhone, listen to gang members inside our prisons talk to one another, record those calls from my iPhone, or shut them down. We're not a law enforcement agency. If we want to have continued access to all that inmate information with respect to who they're calling, why they're calling them, what criminal enterprises they're involved in, we're going to have to go to one of our law enforcement partners under these bills and ask for a warrant. The way the technology industry is moving inside corrections facilities, those phones that you pick up and talk to, 5 years won't be there anymore. They'll be replaced by dedicated cellular phones on an inmate network. Presently, our inmates can also use their MP3 and MP4 players to send out and receive email. We monitor that email traffic just like we would handwritten mail that comes in and out. In the last 18 months, we've had a couple of cases where we don't have license plate technology cameras. We use regular surveillance equipment related to thefts on our property, people high-grading copper pipe and wire. We had an inmate escape from Mill Creek where we captured the license plate of the girlfriend who stopped, picked up the inmate, and ran out of town with him. We have staff misconduct cases that we investigate. In one instance, we had a staff member call an inmate over 914 times. In order to establish a case for termination, we had to listen to those phone calls. The Department of Corrections would be asking for an exemption from these statutory provisions to those kinds of things that happen inside that impact our security functions. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Gentlemen, thank you very much. Our last person that's on the schedule today is Amy Joyce. Amy?
Chair Przanski and members of the committee, Amy Joyce from the Department of Transportation submitted a significant piece of written testimony about the ways in which the department uses technology that would be covered in specific under Senate Bill 640. We use technology to help with the flow of transportation on our transportation system, and I think inadvertently we are caught up in this bill. We've talked with staff to two of the sponsors of the bill and would welcome the opportunity to work with folks on how to recognize the ways we use this technology, the ways we protect people's personal information, and look towards amendments. Since the 2014 session, when this became quite an issue, the department really took to heart the issue of the way we are using technology and the concerns brought forward. So we spent the last year working on a policy by which the agency on current uses of technology and looking into the future, which we really can't say what 5 or 10 years from now would exist to help us operate in a safe and efficient transportation system will look like. But going forward, we have now a policy in place to guide our use, our collection, our storage, and discarding of information. And one of the main ways we do that is by when we use, for instance, Bluetooth readers in the Portland metro area to help with traffic flow. We truncate and scramble MAC addresses from Bluetooth readers so that we never know whose device is being recognized, but we can track a device going from point A to point B to figure out how long it's going to take to get to downtown Portland, for instance. So again, we use this information. We've got good policies in place, and we welcome the opportunity to work on these bills going forward.
Thank you very much. So that concludes everyone that's on the witness list. So I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearings on Senate Bill 316, 639, 640, 641, and 904. And then I'm going to also note that we had another bill that was scheduled for today, Senate Bill 861. No one signed up. I'll check to see if there anyone walked in late that wanted to talk on 861. Not seeing any, so we won't be taking care of that one at this point. And we're adjourned today, and we'll be back tomorrow at 8:30. Thank you.